of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include, For Passion or Money, More Seniors Keep Working, and Why Millennials Are Struggling. And we'll begin with, For Passion or Money, More Seniors Keep Working. At 76, Anne Doan is still stocking shelves in a Wegmans here, leaning to fill a display with hairbrushes as Don Henley's Boys of Summer plays over the store's sound system. I've never saved throughout my life, so therefore I have to do this, Doan said, and because I like it. I want to get out of the house, I want to talk to people, and I need the money. More U.S. workers are working after turning 65, both out of financial necessity and to stay busy, a trend the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics sees increasing over the next 10 years. The Bureau projects the share of seniors working or actively looking for jobs to rise from 19.6% in 2018 to 23.3% in 2028, nearly double the rate of 1998, when it was less than 12%. More than 160,000 seniors are working in grocery stores, earning an average of about $31,000 a year. About half of the more than 9 million workers 65 or older are in retail, health care, business services, or education, according to Bureau of Labor Statistics data and a state line analysis of current population survey microdata. Some of the highest paying jobs for seniors are in colleges and universities, where the average salary for the age group is more than $93,000 a year, and in charity and advocacy groups, where the average for the age group is more than $107,000 a year. It may be a shock for people to find that they can't get by on Social Security alone, especially for those who claim their benefits before they turn 70. Social Security currently maxes out at $2,209 a month for those who file at 62, and $3,770 for those who file at 70. It's particularly tough when the cost of living is high in areas such as Ashburn in Luton County, a fast-growing Washington, D.C. suburb where more than a quarter of the people 65 or older hold jobs, according to recent census data. Working by older age groups bottomed out in the mid-1990s when Social Security was more generous and defined benefit pensions were more common, said Brian Asquith, an economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Michigan. Growth in the number of older workers since then has been slower than expected, he said. Even union jobs may not provide much of a pension now. Venorica Tucker, 70, has had a union job as a banquet server for 30 years, commuting from suburban Maryland to the U.S. House of Representatives. She works for a catering contractor, putting in long days that extend from early morning breakfasts to evening receptions. Her food and beverage workers union has a pension plan, but it's a lump sum of less than $20,000, she said. I had all these ideas about how one could live well after age 65, but those ideas didn't pan out, said Tucker, who's been working similar jobs since the early 1960s when she was 12 and currently holds a second job as a bartender. I should have saved more. I always saw people in my family who were in a needy situation and my friends. They needed help, and I could do it, so I did do it, Tucker said. Sometimes I did that at the cost of paying my own bills and saving. Immigrants often have little choice but to keep working after 65, said 67-year-old Wilbur Ruiz, who works retrieving carts at a Giant supermarket in Ashburn, Virginia. He had once hoped to be retired at this age in his native Peru, reading literature and writing poetry. Possibly for a certain type of worker, when they're older, they need to do something to stay occupied, Ruiz said in Spanish. But under the conditions that most Latinos are in, it's to pay for an apartment, pay for a car to get to work. They survive, and that's all. States are scrambling to fund more job training programs for seniors, especially in Vermont, where 26% of older people held jobs in 2018, the highest rate in the country, up from 23% in 2013, according to a state-line analysis of Bureau of Labor Statistics data. Vermont has a combination of a labor shortage and a large senior population that draws more older residents into the workforce, said Matthew Barwitz, an economist at the Vermont Department of Labor. Some are also working because they love their jobs. It's a passion thing for me, said Diane Dalmas, 71, director of the Vermont Division of Vocational Rehabilitation in Waterbury. She has a state pension that would allow her to retire, but she doesn't want to do that yet. We make a difference, and I just love the work, Dalmas said. Work is how people are measured in this country. The employment rate among older workers is increasing fastest in Colorado, Minnesota, and Hawaii, where the additional numbers of older workers seeking jobs may be raising unemployment rates despite more job creation, as older workers see an opening in a tight labor market and possible higher wages. In Colorado, people are working longer because they can, said Brian Lewandowski, Associate Director of the Research Division at the University of Colorado. We are healthier than average, and this is a state with a lot of white-collar jobs. If you have a desk job as an accountant or an attorney, you can easily keep doing this. State programs to train older workers with federal funds are overwhelmed by applications from people who can't get in, said Pat Elmer, president of Associates for Training and Development, a nonprofit that operates training programs in Vermont, Maine, New York, and Pennsylvania. And next, why millennials are struggling. 4 or 5 years ago, having breakfast at the counter in a popular Annapolis, Maryland eatery, I struck up a casual conversation with a stranger sitting next to me. I remember it as if it happened yesterday. This father, for all the right reasons, had pushed his son to get a college degree and counseled him to borrow money to do so. The son had incurred a loan in excess of $100,000 and graduated into an economy of few job openings. He had no good job and no money to pay his debt. The father's pain, guilt, and sense of regret were palpable. This is what happened to millennials following the 2008 Great Recession. Millennials are generally defined to be those born from 1981 to 1996, now 22 to 37-year-olds. Some refer to them as the generation who refuses to grow up. No mortgage, no career plans, no marriage, no children. Why is this? Why have they not done as well as their parents? Millennials came of age during a time of dramatic technological change, the proliferation of social media, globalization, and economic disruption. For a better life, a bachelor's degree became all but prerequisite for an adequate wage. The Great Recession unloaded on millennials. They have lived through a slow 10-year recovery of a weak labor market and declining wages. College tuition had risen sharply, and the federal loans incurred to repay it have been a considerable burden. Students can no longer work their way through college while taking classes the way they once could. Two-thirds of students who earned a four-year degree in 2017 borrowed to pay for school. Growing numbers of these loan debts are in arrears or in default. Those in charge of these programs, aging politicians, and policymakers favor the corporations, the wealthier, and those over 65, the most reliable voters. This year's expected $1 trillion deficit will add to the national debt of $22 trillion. In America's rapidly aging society, every day about 10,000 individuals become eligible for Medicare. The children and grandchildren of today's adults are on the hook for these obligations. We now face another possible recession, which would be the second to hit the millennials. To be employed in a stagnant and failing economy, a college education and technical training will be required. But these qualifications will not necessarily return an adequate salary. According to a Deloitte study, millennials are doing far worse financially than generations before them. Their average net worth is below $8,000, a 34% drop in average net worth since 1996. The study found millennials' incomes have largely flatlined. To pay off the lasting burden of the $1.6 trillion student debt could take many borrowers a lifetime. These debts sap their life and career dreams. A Bloomberg Businessweek analysis found that U.S. student loan borrowers, as a group, are paying down only about 1% of their federal student loan debt every year. The Great Recession created a particularly daunting challenge for millennials entering the job market. It has left a hangover of uncertainty and lost opportunity. It has affected their future earnings and wealth. Millennials live in a world much less safe, predictable, and prosperous than did their parents. Their work is much less secure and the pay less certain. Neither the U.S. economy nor the government has delivered a better world for them than that experienced by their parents. And this is an editorial by Perry L. Weed, who is a founder and director of the Economic Club of Annapolis, Maryland. And next, Charlotte Ways changes as new tech jobs roll in. The types of jobs that have come along in some of the City of Charlotte's recent economic development announcements have propelled the public, nonprofit, and private sectors to think differently about recruitment and incentives. New York-based digital mortgage lender Better.com said September 16th that with the opening of its new office at WeWork in South End, the company plans to hire for 100 jobs by year's end and up to 1,000, possibly even more in 5 years. With such large job promises typically comes an incentives award, usually from the city, county, and state, but no grants were awarded to Better for its expansion into Charlotte. That's because the way the city's business investment program is written does not currently qualify a company opening or expanding in co-working space like WeWork to receive a grant. Current policy dictates that the amount of incentives offered to a company is determined in part by the percentage of property taxes paid through a company investing in a new headquarters building, for example. Better.com will build its local workforce at WeWork at the rail yard for the foreseeable future, but no concrete plans have been made yet for a more permanent space, said Vishal Garg, the company's founder and CEO. Fran West, who works on business recruitment and other projects in the city's economic development department, says conversations began this spring with Better.com, including around incentives. The city will launch a pilot program that would allow companies expanding or relocating to Charlotte, even if it initially goes to a co-working space, to have the opportunity to receive some type of grant. Charlotte City Council would have to approve such a program. And next, from the Triangle Business Journal, construction snapshot. Triangle Business Journal dug through the latest report from the Associated General Contractors of America to get a feel for the status of the construction industry in North Carolina. The report centers on the economic impact of the construction industry in the U.S. and in North Carolina specifically. Here are a few of the findings from that report. Non-residential construction spending. Non-residential spending in the U.S. totaled $748 billion in 2018, $453 billion private, $295 billion public, and $714 billion in 2017. Private non-residential spending in North Carolina totaled $9.3 billion in 2018. State and local spending totaled $6.2 billion. Non-residential starts in North Carolina totaled $14.8 billion in 2018 and $14.3 billion in 2017, according to Construct Connect. Construction employment, seasonally adjusted. Construction, residential plus non-residential, employed 7.4 million workers in March 2019, an increase of 246,000, that's 3.4%, from March 2018, but 3.6% less than in April 2006, when U.S. construction employment peaked. Construction employment in North Carolina in March 2019 totaled 222,500, an increase of 2.2% from March 2018, but 13% less than the state's peak in March 2007. Construction unemployment is near a series low. And in AGC's 2019 Hiring and Business Outlook Survey, 78% of firms in the U.S. and 97% in North Carolina reported difficulty filling salaried and hourly craft worker positions. And next, from the Triangle Business Journal, Small Business Finding Consensus. Set firm guidelines to build collaborative decisions. The 9-member senior leadership team was making a strategic decision about the vendor for installing a new supply chain software system costing millions of dollars. 2 members disagreed vehemently with the choice. They debated for about 2 hours before the CEO got fed up and called the question. The team voted 7-2 for the vendor. After 18 months and major cost overruns, the new system went online, only to experience a number of failures within the first few weeks. The 2 members who voted against at the next meeting said, "I told you so. If you had listened, we would have told you about our previous experiences with this vendor." The company lost millions of dollars and credibility because they had a can-live-with-it consensus decision-making rule. There are many who believe that consensus is groupthink, a failure of leadership, or the suppression of dissent. There is always disagreement on teams. The question is whether you speed bump those who disagree or actually listen and work through the differences. A 100% true consensus, no reservations decision making rule is the gold standard for collaboration. It requires teams to work through their disagreements and in the process strengthens trust and accountability. In my experience, it always results in better decisions. The real issue is not if there is value in consensus-based decision-making, but whether we have the commitment to honor and respect everyone's point of view. Also, the question is how to create this rule. I cannot tell you how many times I've heard the statement, "We don't believe you can have consensus on anything." That view can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. We know that teams make better decisions than individuals most of the time, so let's see how to make it happen. Form a collaborative team. Teams need to play by the same rules. The collaborative team governance process helps teams create them. Rules for making operating agreements. The key to the success of this process is team members agreeing that whatever their decision-making agreement is, they will all agree to that by 100%. Focus it on strategic decisions. Facilitated process. The process needs to be facilitated by an objective third party. Decision-making rules. There are 6 decision-making rules to choose from. One person decides, minority rule, majority rule, supermajority, 80-20, can live with it, consensus 90%, and 100% true consensus. How to disagree? The team will also need to agree on how they will disagree. No running over people who disagree. Patience and persistence. Patience is critical and frustration will be high. The value of the process for the team is that it builds trust and mutual respect. Persistence in the face of frustration will be rewarded with a deeper understanding of each other. The payoff from this process is both short and long term. Building true consensus results in high trust, ownership, mutual respect, and accountability among team members. There are no more "I told you so's" and no more 7-2 decisions. As one client said, "I can't believe we operated the other way for so long. There is no going back." And this was written by Edward Marshall. He's an author and adjunct professor in management at the Fuqua School of Business and the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University. And next, looking to make an impact in mental health, and this is part of the Executive Voice column by Jeff Williams. For years, behavioral health care has fought a cultural stigma that kept patients from seeking the proper treatments. That same stigma has also warded off the industry from the investments and expansions that private and public dollars have afforded countless other medical advancements. But as stigmas have thawed, a group of Raleigh venture capitalists, River City's Capital Funds, saw an opportunity in the space by purchasing Carolina Partners in mental health care, the largest practice in the state. by tapping Jeff Williams, the former CEO of Clinipace, to lead the state's largest network of 162 behavioral health providers across 9 cities. They hope the rebranded MindPath Care Centers can expand its offerings of the full spectrum of mental care, from therapy for general anxiety to serious psychiatric conditions. With new capital behind the company, Williams believes its practices are set to explode across the U.S. Why did River Cities become interested in this part of healthcare? If you think about healthcare in general, for years we've seen a kind of consolidation and roll-ups in the creation of these big physician management companies. Behavioral healthcare really hasn't experienced that consolidation and the kind of investment or growth strategy, but the time is now because it's such a big need. Our investors felt there was a huge opportunity to begin to get involved in the beginning of what we think is going to be a significant growth phase for companies at scale that can provide behavioral and mental health care services. What's different now? For forever, mental and behavioral health care coverage was limited. Now it has to be covered just as a kind of regular primary care. And frankly, the dollars just aren't in behavioral and mental health care. They're in these bigger multi-specialties or in these medical fields where there's ancillary services that you can sell along with your care delivery. That's just not the case with mental health care. It just doesn't have the same kind of margins. Money follows money, so I just think people are following those types of activities. But we're at a point now where even with a lower margin service, we can begin to, at scale, also pursue returns that are interesting for an investor. And River City saw that here. We're the largest by far in the state of North Carolina and one of the largest in the entire country. We have 162 providers at the moment, and by the end of the year, we'll have another 10 or 15. We're hiring constantly because of the demand. We don't even know where the top is on the demand. The need is so large that to the extent we can continue to add providers, we can fill them up, and we can achieve the scale that we are after. And you know you can say scale is all business speak, but on the patient side, that translates to access to mental and behavioral health care. Do you think the stigma against mental health is changing? The lack of stigma with millennials is pretty healthy. In fact, with a lot of folks, it's even kind of cool to have a therapist. That's pretty cool, and if we try to reverse that way of thinking about it back through the generations, well, that's even better. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time.